Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist for Freedom of Faith. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
The Gist of Freedom. My name is Preston Washington. I'm your host tonight for this program. We're coming to you over www.blackhistoryblog.com. And again, that number, if you want to get involved in tonight's discussion, is 347-324-5552. Our guest tonight is Kimberly Simmons. who is president and executive director of a nonprofit organization called the Detroit River Project. She's also a fifth-generation descendant of individuals involved in the Underground Railroad.
Can you hear me?
I'm hearing something on the air. Is that you, Leslie? Kimberly?
This is Kim. Leslie just sent me a message. I just wanted to let you know I was here.
Okay, great. I was just letting our listeners know that you are our guest tonight and about your work as the president and executive director of the Detroit River Project, and that you're also a seventh generation descendant from the Mayflower, as well as a fifth generation descendant from individuals involved in the Underground Railroad. And you've been cited. I think there's two congressional proclamations in your honor for the work that you've done there with the Detroit River Project, which is part of the Michigan Freedom Trail Commission, which is part of the Underground Railroad Commission, as I understand it. And that you are also involved in a national program and you're a site partner for the United States National Park Service, Underground Railroad Network to Freedom. Also, there's a book project that you are involved in. It'll be coming out in late 2013. Could you tell us about that?
Absolutely. And let me just kind of separate the projects. I'm an appointed commissioner of one of the state of Michigan's historical commissions. It's Michigan Freedom Trail, and that is the Underground Railroad Commission for the state of Michigan. The Detroit River Project is actually in partnership with the Michigan Freedom Trail Commission, completing the book that you just cited, The Fluid Frontier. The Fluid Frontier is a 12-chapter book regarding the Underground Railroad legacy cross-border, international border, because for those that maybe I'll remind everyone of their geography, Detroit sits on an international border. We are literally a stone's throw away across a bridge, or for that matter, a tunnel, to Windsor, Canada. So this region, southwestern Ontario and southeastern Michigan, are basically joined at the hip by the river. And we are writing a 12-chapter book regarding those stories that cross the river, freedom stories, and it will be published in the fall of 2013. 12 chapters, 12 different authors, I should say. Six are Canadian and six are American. That'll kind of put it in front of you, because there's so many stories on both sides of the river. And They're all interconnected. I hope that straightens that out.
Yes, it does. Thank you. And you had some family members involved in the Underground Railroad. Where do you would you like to start with that?
Where should I start? Well, I am fifth generation Underground Railroad. My great 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 grandparents were both freedom seekers, and this is my mother's side of the family, my maternal side. My great 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 grandmother, her name was Carolyn Quarles. It became Carolyn Quarles Watkins because she married a man by the name of Alan Watkins, who too was a freedom seeker. Carolyn was born in 1826. She was born in St. Louis, Missouri. She was born to a very old Virginia planter family. She was the daughter of one of the sons of the house and one of the enslaved. She was the granddaughter of her owner, and her grandfather's name was Robert Quarles. He was a Revolutionary War patriot. She was the daughter of a woman by the name of Maria, who would have been my great-great-great-great-grandmother. And her father's name was Robert Pryor Quarles, son of the house, and a War of 1812 veteran. She escaped to freedom, to Midnight, which is Detroit, in the Underground Railroad world, code word name. She escaped in 1842 at the age of 16 years old. She was slight of build. She was freckled, blue-eyed, very keen-featured, jet-black hair hung down her back, and for that description, she looked like her cousins in the house.
How did you find out about this, Cam?
Carolyn's story has been researched quite a bit. I personally nor the family can really claim that we have researched her family, her diligently, primarily mm-hmm. because Carolyn's escape was the first documented Underground Railroad escape through the state of Wisconsin in 1842. So Carolyn in the Midwest is a folk heroine. As a matter of fact, in the Wisconsin school system, they do Carolyn Quarles' story instead of doing, say, for example, Harriet Tubman. So Carolyn's escape at 16 years old, and I might say on the 4th of July, 1842, has been researched quite a bit by the Wisconsin Historical Society. There are historical markers all over the state. The University of Wisconsin, in particular, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, has done research on her. Her trail has been tracked because we are fortunate, the family is fortunate, about 10 years ago, Carolyn was helped out of the state of Wisconsin and actually to Detroit by a gentleman by the name of Lyman Goodnow. He was her Underground Railroad conductor. And about 10 years ago, in the attic of one of Mr. Goodnow's descendants, they found within a stack of Civil War letters, three letters that were handwritten, dated 1881, written by both Carolyn and her soon-to-be husband, Alan Watkins. They were found intact in their own envelopes, folded up and looked as if they had just been folded and put in the mail. And they literally detailed both Carolyn and Alan's Underground Railroad escape from where they left. They named names, places, bridges. Alan's was pretty detailed. He escaped from Kentucky around Maysville. Mm-hmm. And he even detailed the fact that bounty hunters, he was on a double-decker bridge, and bounty hunters literally were over. He had to get down into the Ohio and watch them cross over above his head. So the letters are quite rare, As I said, they were found just about 10 years ago, and they now are the center of an exhibit at the Kenosha Civil War Museum in Kenosha, Wisconsin. They are the centerpiece to what is called the Fiery Trial, which tells the tale of the Civil War in the Midwest. So,
how long will they be on display there?
They're permanent display.
Yes.
Permanent
display.
Well, when I say permanent display, the exhibit is permanent. It is the actual centerpiece of the museum. Some of the other exhibits change, but the Fiery Trial gives the backdrop on why the Civil War existed or had to exist. And
great.
Being a Kenosha Civil War Museum, they actually rotate the letters. They're very rare, priceless, and they rotate the letters, so you might see original or a copy at any given time, but all three letters are rotated. They actually were answers to Lyman Goodnow after 30 years.
Do you have copies of the letters?
Letters are actually answers. Lyman Goodnow actually sent a letter, general delivery to Sandwich, where Carolyn actually ended her escape. And about 30 years later, he was writing his memoirs, and he reached out to her. He hadn't seen her in 30 years, and he sent her a letter, general delivery, and it was delivered to her home and handed to her by the postmaster. So the three letters that were found 10 years ago were the replies. He asked her a specific set of questions, and she was able to answer his questions and actually literally tell her story through this letter. She named her father. She named the place she was born, which is on the corner of 6th and Pine in St. Louis, which exists right now. It's a parking lot. But if you go back to 1852 and check the directory, there was a house there that was owned by a gentleman by the name of Charles Hall, who became her owner after her grandfather died, and his home stood there. So you can literally trace her story all the way across the upper Midwest for 1,000 miles. And
let me interrupt a moment, Kim. Early on, you mentioned, I heard the name Quarles. Connection in your family to Benjamin Quarles?
Well, you know, I was speaking about that just the other day, and I say to people, the Quarles men, there were three men that came over from England. They came over before, as part of the early part of the Virginia colony. And there were three brothers, Quarles brothers. One ended up in Connecticut, and the other two in Virginia. And anyone in the United States with that last name is interrelated way back somewhere. We're all interrelated. I know Benjamin Quarles and his work, and I can probably say without hesitation he's related, but I couldn't tell you where, when, how, or why. But the Quarles family is a very old Virginia family, and as a matter of fact, the Quarles can trace themselves back, or I guess I should say we can trace ourselves back to Charlemagne. The Quarles family was born out of Henry II, which was Charlemagne's son. So the Quarles family can trace themselves back a very, very long way.
Now, what is her connection to Mr. Leary, Lewis
Leary?
Well,
that's the Langstons, Lewis Leary, one of the five African-Americans that were at Harper's Ferry, was actually the cousin to the Langstons. He was involved in Oberlin, the Wellington incident. He was there.
What was that Wellington incident?
The Wellington incident. That was the incident that I think was you guys talked about a little bit maybe last week regarding the escape of, I believe it was John Price. I have to go back. Oh, you know, I can't think without my glasses. Maybe put my glasses on.
That was John Price.
Yes. The Wellington incident involved the Oberlin Anti-Slavery Society, of which the Langstons belonged.
And that was Oberlin, Ohio, where this took place. Is that correct?
Oberlin, Ohio.
When you say Oberlin, yes. A lot of our listeners may not understand, you know, when we give the city without giving a state. That's okay, but it was Oberlin, Ohio,
right?
And John Price, had been rescued by your ancestor, Louis Leary, along with John Brown.
Correct.
Is that okay? Tell us, can you give us some details in that that we may to make sure that our audience understands what was going on?
Well, first, do we know what Oberlin is about? Oberlin, Ohio, was probably one of the most Oberlin College is the first college in the Midwest that actually accepted African Americans. From Oberlin, you've got a lot of it almost was the epicenter in the midst of the abolitionist world. Because out of Oberlin, John Brown spent a lot of time in Oberlin. The Langston brothers, John, Charles, Gideon, and their sister Maria, actually ended in Oberlin after they were taken out of Virginia. The Langstons are actually Quarles. The Langston brothers, John Mercer, Charles Langston, Gideon Langston, and Maria, their sister, were born of Ralph Quarles, plantation owner in Virginia, and the brother to my fifth great grandfather, Robert. When Ralph died, they were transported out of Virginia for safety because they actually had been left in the will. They actually were to inherit everything. And their mother never married to Ralph, of course. She was African American. Her name was Mary Langston. Therefore, the sons were sent out of Virginia and sent to Ohio with family friends. So typically you would look at them, their name should have been Quarles, you know, if we were in a time mm-hmm. now, their name would have been Quarles. But they carried her name because of the marriage problem. Therefore, who we're talking about, we are actually talking about the Quarles family. Louis Leary, and who was the uncle to John Copeland, actually were cousins to the Langstons through their mother, Mary. So that's literally what you have. The Oberlin Anti-Slavery Society was almost made up of entirely, it was a large society, but out of the society you had eight or nine of them that actually were related, but you wouldn't know it because the names weren't changed. But you were talking about okay. the same family. So
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, our audience should know, too, that Oberlin in 1788 was part of the ordnance land grant. Revolutionary soldiers were given land grants in Ohio, and that's the reason it attracted so many individuals who later on were involved in the Underground Railroad. They were somewhat radical. And I also want to make a correction on the John Price. It wasn't John Brown, but rather John Copeland.
John Copeland, correct. Mm-hmm.
Who was involved in that, and it was John Brown who was involved in the Harper's Ferry. Now, was Lewis your ancestor involved with Mr. Copeland and John Brown?
Lewis Leary and John Copeland. Lewis Leary and Copeland were Lewis Leary was Copeland's uncle.
Oh, okay.
They went to the two of them and three others were actually at Harper's Ferry with John Brown because they would have been interacting with John Brown through the Oberlin Anti-Slavery Society and their cousins, the Langstons. These people were interacting all the time. Oberlin being the center of the abolitionist movement, if you want to say, they were interacting mm-hmm. all the time. It wasn't a matter of suddenly they appeared. These were people that interacted all the time. You know, the abolitionist movement, for those that don't know, was a family-driven thing, both black and white. Families literally traveled across country and would deposit people along their route. say, for example, you had a family from Massachusetts or a family from usually the Northeast, they may start traveling across country, and maybe one of the brothers or one of the sisters would end up in, we'll say, West Virginia. And then a little further on, you might find somebody in Ohio. And as I have, over the course of the last 15 years or so, as I've really delved into a lot more of the family research, you have to be very careful because the names sometimes are different. I'll use my family's history as to give an example. I have a gentleman, his name was Samuel Brown. He helped in the escape of my ancestor, Carolyn Quarles, when she escaped out of St. Louis. He lived in Milwaukee. He was one of Milwaukee's founders. He married three times. The first time he married, he originally was from Massachusetts. His wife died and he left Massachusetts, moved across country, met another woman, and married her, and they lived together in and around Chicago area. He lost her, left Chicago, and ended up in Milwaukee. Well, when he was in Chicago, the lady that he married, her last name, her maiden name was Daughtry. Okay, he moved on, ended up in Milwaukee, married another lady. Well, during the course of the Underground Railroad escape story that is my ancestors, when she got to Milwaukee and was helped by Samuel Brown, it's said in the story that he delivers her to a deacon, Daughtry. Well, you know, that meant nothing to the family as we had heard our story, but as I spent so much time in Milwaukee digging through old periodicals and obituaries, I discovered Daughtry was Samuel Brown's second father-in-law. But unless you actually started looking at the names and checking, you were asking about the genealogy, checking out birth certificates, death certificates, stories, you would never know that. You would never know that. It would have been lost. But that's just an example of abolitionist families. They traveled together in families. They intermarried each other's sons and daughters. And you have to pay particular attention to that. That takes us back to the Oberlin Gang. There was a lot of interrelationships there that made that whole society stronger. And it makes a lot of the abolitionist societies, as you look around through the North, the societies are stronger because you have a lot of interrelationships. In the case of Lewis Leary, he was Copeland's uncle, and he was cousin to the Langstons. You would never know that. They all carry different names. And remember, that would have been the case because they were African-Americans. And depending on who, Lewis Leary was a half. Depending on who Mommy and Daddy were, they all would have carried different names, but they were interrelated.
Mm-hmm. So what primary sources do you have for those connections? And those letters that you mentioned earlier, were you able to make any copies of those letters?
Yes, the letters, the originals actually belong to the Kenosha Civil War Museum, but there are copies of them. Actually, I own high-resolution copies that were given to me by the museum, but you can get copies of those letters. You have to go through the Kenosha Civil War Museum to get those, but they are available. They will allow copies to be made. I'm not sure to say how much that would cost anyone, but if you were doing research and wanted to view them, you could.
And what about, are you aware of any abolitionist families in Ripley, Ohio?
In Ripley, that would be the Rankins. And to be honest, that's not part of my research. I don't really touch on the Ohio part except through the Quarles branch, so that would be something some other expert would probably be able to speak more intelligently on is Ripley. I can tell you more about my family's connection to Oberlin and to the Missouri raid with John Brown. I can tell you a little bit more of that connection, but Ripley's a little bit off the family tree.
Okay. Well, tell us a little bit about the your family's involvement in the Harper's Ferry raid, and then when we conclude there, we can go into your relationship with Langston Hughes. Tell us about the raid.
Okay. Well, Harper's Ferry. Harper's Ferry was planned, and again, family connections. Lewis Leary, having been involved in the Oberlin Wellington rescue.
Excuse me, Kim. Let me cut you off for just a moment. I want the callers to know that we see them. We know you're there, and we'll get you in as soon as we can. We'll start about 8:40 or so, in another 14 minutes or so. Okay? We see you, callers. Go ahead, Kim.
Okay. I have to go back. Lewis Leary.
The Harper's Ferry raid.
Okay. He and would have been involved with the Oberlin. He was involved with the Oberlin Wellington rescue, which actually involved Charles Langston. Charles Langston went to jail for that. Lewis Leary married a woman by the name of Mary Patterson. When John Brown was recruiting for this Harper's Ferry raid, there were several meetings that were had. There was a meeting in Chatham, Ontario, in May of 1858. And then the second meeting, not the last one, but the last one before the actual raid was actually here in Detroit. It was on March the 12th, 1859. And in attendance at that meeting was John Brown. Frederick Douglass actually was here, had been here speaking at our local historic Second Baptist Church. And John Brown had actually been shipped out of Chicago with the entire Daniels family after escaping out of Missouri, hence the Missouri raid, cross-country and being chased by the cavalry. Ended up in Chicago and was rescued by being put on a train in a boxcar for $500 by Alan Pinkerton. Ended up in Detroit, and the second meeting was had here in downtown Detroit on Harper's Ferry. It was decided then that Frederick Douglass didn't want to be involved. Hence, it went back into the hands of a lot of the Oberlin, Wellington Anti-Slavery Society, as well as the Detroit Vigilance Society, which was centered here in Detroit. Lewis Leary, having been with John Brown and with Charles Langston, involved with the Oberlin Wellington escape, was signified, as well as his nephew, to be one of the African Americans that were going to be with John Brown. Mary, who became Mary Leary, they had a daughter, and when it was decided that Lewis Leary was going to become a member of this band, he left. He didn't give any details. I guess at that point you didn't give details to your wife, you just left. And he left her and traveled to Chatham prior to the raid. As they were gathering steam, they actually started up in Ontario before they moved down back into the States. Remember, John Brown was a marked man. So Lewis Leary actually left his wife, Mary, with a daughter, and traveled with John Brown. The Harper's Ferry raid happened in October 16th, 1859, to be exact. And it was said, and, you know, I commented on Facebook, I think, last week, that everyone died except for one. Well, that's not true. Lewis Leary did not, he died of his wounds, but he lived long enough to write a letter to his wife to tell her that where he had gone, what had happened, and to say he was sorry he would not see her again. He lived 10 days after that. Mary accepted that. And, of course, was widowed and became the wife of Charles Langston. Again, the family intermarried.
Do you know where Do you know where Louis Leary is buried?
You know, that's a good question. He swam across the Shenandoah, and I'm not sure if he's, I have a sneaking suspicion that he is buried somewhere close to Harper's Ferry, but I can't tell you where he's buried. That'd probably be something good to research is where he is buried.
So his widow then marries
Charles Langston, his cousin.
Langston, his cousin, okay.
Charles Langston married Mary Leary. She became Mary Langston. They had a daughter, and they named the daughter Mary. Was a family name. We got so many Marys in the family. It's pretty wild. But Mary had a daughter, and the daughter married a gentleman by the name of Hughes. And again, you're talking about changing names. Mary and Charles's grandson, their daughter's son, was Langston Hughes.
Langston lived in Lawrence, Kansas.
That's correct.
Langston Hughes and John Brown also went into Lawrence, Kansas. Do you know if he recruited any of Langston's descendants that were involved in any of the action in Kansas against the so-called border ruffians?
Okay, back up. Langston Hughes is another generation, so let's back up one. Are you talking about Charles?
Okay. Well, Charles Hughes, yeah.
Charles Langston?
I'm sorry.
Right, let's back up. Okay, you have John and Charles Langston, who were John Brown's friends and co-conspirators. So you're talking Charles Langston, correct?
All right, and Leary's widow married a Langston.
Married Charles Langston.
Okay, I've got you now.
Okay. They became the grandparents of Langston Hughes.
Okay. Now, did they move to Kansas, to Lawrence, Kansas?
Yes, they did.
The Langstons?
Yes, right.
Okay.
Now we're there. They spent time in Lawrence, Kansas, yes. That's why you've got Langston University, you've got Langston, Oklahoma. The Langston name was used all over the Middle Midwest because the Langstons had been there. John Mercer Langston became one of the first African Americans elected to Congress, but he wasn't perhaps the most well versed in abolitionist activities. It probably was his brother Charles. I would be closer to saying Charles was. John Mercer was an attorney. Charles Langston was not. So John Langston would have been able to. There were things he would have done that he would not have done that Charles did. That's why Charles was arrested for the Oberlin Wellington rescue. He was arrested and put in jail. Whereas John Mercer carrying that attorney title did not necessarily cross some of those borders. He did things that he knew legally he could do. So it was a little different. The Langstons, the family's quite interesting. Of course, John Langston became the first president of Howard, and interesting. It's an interesting family. Langston Hughes. I tell people when you read his poetry. And you read the prose. What Langston is doing is talking about the family. When he speaks of his grandmother, his grandmother raised him, and whenever he speaks of hard times and hard trials, he's speaking about his home family and his grandmother. He wrote later that. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Did any of your ancestors fight in Kansas, or they're involved in what was known as Bloody Kansas?
Bloody Kansas.
Yeah.
Charles Langston.
Charles
John
Langston,
Mercer's
okay.
Brother and Louis Leary's cousin.
Okay.
And grandfather of Langston Hughes.
And So they participated there in Bloody Kansas. Do you know if that was under the direction of John Brown, or was that a generation removed?
Well, the Kansas Border Wars, John Brown was involved in, but okay, I think we're mixing up generations here. Let's see.
Okay.
Because you're talking about the Langstons. The Langstons are the same generation as John Brown. And then when you take a step down, that you're taking a step into Langston. So where are we? Because that
okay.
About 18.
It would be the Langstons if they moved to Kansas and they're doing the border war between Missouri and Kansas that John
right.
Brown was involved in, and he
right.
was a compatriot. So your family was involved in that.
Charles Langston was, yes.
Charles Langston, yes. Okay. Well, let's move back to Langston Hughes and his grandmother you were telling us about.
Yes. Langston Hughes often spoke of his grandmother, and he wrote later, at the turn of the century, when they actually declared, Teddy Roosevelt set up the National Parks System. Harper's Ferry became one of the first National Historic Sites. And at the time that it was dedicated, Langston Hughes proudly wrote that his grandmother, Mary, was one of the last widows left of the Harper's Ferry incident. She was the last one. She sat on the podium. He was quite proud of that. The family history, we're quite proud of that. The family history, as you look back, even as it's the intermarriages are concerned, this family has always been about freedom. It's quite astounding, especially when you start seeing the differences in the family tree. But the Langstons themselves were very, very fiery abolitionists, all of them, and the cousins. I think it's because the way I've looked at it over my life is the fact that their, if you want to say birthright, their heritage was challenged so much. The Langston boys, John, Mercer, Charles, they were taken away from a place where they were given total freedom. They were born free. Their father freed them at birth. And rather than live out their days in such a way as freedom in Virginia, which was home to them, they literally had to be taken out of Virginia. And I think that built up a, I don't want to call it hatred, but it made them such strong believers in freedom. That would have carried over into the fact that they would have allowed or suggested that their cousin, Lewis, John Copeland, would have gone to Harper's Ferry. Harper's Ferry was a suicide mission, and anyone mm-hmm. that was involved in it knew that. John Brown thought that this was going to be people, he would have the enslaved and those that were free flocking to Harper's Ferry to join his army and free everyone, and that just it just wasn't time. But they believed so strongly in the mission and in the end result that they would allow a cousin to go basically to his death. That's how strong the family's ties have always been, from the Underground Railroad to even further as you move up through the family chain. It's always been about freedom. We are always about freedom. I think it's in the DNA.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it seems like they had a long relationship with Mr. John Brown. Do you know any details about, or intimate details on how they were recruited and when they first met, anything of that nature?
Well, like I said, you in Lewis Leary's particular case, he participated in the Oberlin Wellington rescue when John Price was actually taken away from a marshal. At that point, he would have been a very big part of what would have been the Oberlin Anti-Slavery Society.
Kim, let me interrupt here a moment. We promised the callers that they would that we would start taking their calls.
Okay.
And let me see if caller number 442, are you there? Are you there, caller? Okay, apparently we got a little technical difficulty there. Charles Langston, and hello, are you there, caller?
Yes, I'm sorry, I was supposed to call with Dorothy Holford. I'm with the project. I'm with the project for the Joyce and Gaines project. I'm sorry, I must have called a little early.
Okay. Did you have a question for our guest, Kimberly Simmons?
Oh, well, actually, I've been listening in this whole time, and no questions, but I just want to say this is actually pretty interesting. This has been very interesting information, and as you've been speaking, I've been on my computer and just passing this in, everything you've been saying and just putting it on Facebook and sharing everything you've been saying on online and sharing it with my Facebook friends. As a matter of fact, yes, I have this one question. You mentioned something in Wisconsin. It was an exhibit. It was way back about Carolyn Quarles.
I'm sorry. You want to say that again? I didn't.
Yes, it was an exhibit about Carolyn Quarles, you said, in Wisconsin.
Yes.
I mean, mistaken. What was the name of that exhibit called?
It's called The Fiery Trial.
The Fiery Trial. Okay.
The Kenosha Civil War Museum.
The Kenosha.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. And
well, thank you, caller.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I just want to say this is I find this very interesting, and I just want to keep sharing it with the folks, my friends on Facebook, and all our followers.
Great. I'm glad you joined us, caller. I think we have a caller from area code 443. Are you there, caller? Okay, apparently... the caller's not there. Hopefully they'll call back. Now, we were talking about earlier, here we're talking about Charles Langston, and he was a graduate of Oberlin College, was he, along with John Mercer and his older brother?
Okay.
Who did you
say now?
Langston and John
Charles Langston
Mercer.
And John, right. Charles and John both went to Oberlin.
And they were graduates of Oberlin.
Correct.
And were they involved in a slave trial just before the Civil War?
Slave trial just before the Civil War. Possibly. They were involved in so much. You know, to be perfectly frank, studying Charles and Lewis Leary and, well, John Mercer and Charles are very interesting characters. So... Charles Langston, as I said, I've said this to other people, John Mercer is probably the most famous, primarily mm-hmm. because he was the first elected African-American congressman from Virginia. But because of that, that makes him more famous, but I would probably wager to guess that Charles was probably a lot more involved than John was in activities that got him in a great deal of trouble. So your question is, was Charles?
Well, and Charles was a graduate of Oberlin College as well.
Yes.
Now John Mercer Langston, he held office. He was a village clerk there in Oberlin.
Yes, he was.
Was he not? And authorized a payment to Mr. Price. I think it came to $1.25 a week.
Yes.
Until he could find a job. And so he was one of the first black lawyers in Ohio?
He was.
Okay.
And the first African-American representative from the state of Virginia.
Okay.
As a special
man. Was he elected or did he take someone's office or replace someone who had passed, or how does that history go?
I believe he was the first elected. I don't believe he took over somebody's position. He became active in the Ohio Oberlin Anti-Slavery Society. He acted as president, traveled around. He was instrumental in getting African Americans to join the Union Army after the Emancipation, which we celebrated today here. And he was involved in the later on. He was involved in the forming of the NAACP. He chaired a committee for the National Equal Rights League. You know, he was involved in quite a bit, and I'm trying to remember. He moved to D.C. He was elected. Believe he was elected in the late 1870. He was appointed in 1885. He returned to Virginia. That's where he actually took over Virginia Normal and Collegiate Institute. He ran for a seat, then was elected. He lost the seat, and contested the election. I think that's the way that went. And after a great deal of back and forth, he actually was declared the winner of the seat. So I guess you would say, you asked, was he elected? Probably was, but he was told that he didn't win, and it was kind of like the classic case of Bush versus Gore. He contested it and was declared the winner later. So would you say he was elected or was he not?
Okay, yeah, that would be a matter of opinion, huh? Have you seen the movies Lincoln and Django?
And you know what? That is my quest for the rest of. I promised myself that I would see both of them after the holidays, because, of course, this is not a time to go during the holidays. I chose not to. I have not seen either one.
Have you been following the controversy
with Django?
With Django, Lincoln.
Well, Django, you know, it's funny. We did a emancipation event today, and celebrated the reading of the Emancipation Proclamation today, January 6th. That's the day it was read the first time in Michigan. And Django came up a lot. Lincoln, I've heard great reviews about, but Lincoln, of course, was about the 13th Amendment and the road that Lincoln had to take to get the 13th Amendment actually ratified. But as far as Django is concerned, I had someone today, and I will repeat what they said. Django was portrayed as a man out of character, if you want to say. I haven't seen the movie, but I've heard enough about it. That person that we did not, it would have been some sort of a special breed that fought so hard to get back to his wife, and fought against the enslavement of his people. But we were reminded today by several different people that we have all always been Django. And that is, we have always fought for our freedom. But people don't necessarily talk so much about that. They know about the famous cases, yes. But we have always, as a people, fought for our freedom, always. There's always been a rabble-rouser fighting for our freedom. So I haven't seen either one of the movies. I do intend to see them, hopefully before the week is out, but I wanted to kind of miss the rush. But I am actually reading a Team of Rivals, which is the book that actually Lincoln was actually based upon, was Doris Goodwin's book on Mr. Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
Team of Rivals actually happens to be our president's favorite book, too. So, and it's funny, as I'm reading it, he uses a lot of strategy that Mr. Lincoln had. So it's quite eye-opening, as a matter of fact. What about yourself?
Well, I have not seen either one, either of the movies, but I really want to thank you for your comments relative to those individuals who were out there fighting for their freedom, seeking their freedom, and that, you know, Ms. Gist has been very diligent in getting this message out, that black folks were involved in their own freedom. And it's so heartwarming to me, for me to meet a descendant who can actually trace back and know that your people were involved in that, and you can document it, and they were in the fight from day one, and sounds like you're still in it. So I really appreciate your comments on the freedom fighters back in the day. Would you let our listeners know how they can contact you if they have further questions or comments that we won't be able to get to tonight? Could you do that for us?
Absolutely. I can be contacted, of course, on Facebook. My Facebook page is Kimberly Simmons. I can be contacted that way. I also can be reached by email. My email address is DetroitRiverProject@gmail.com.
Is that email or Gmail?
Gmail.com.
Gmail. Okay.
Yes.
Detroit River Project.
At gmail.com.
Okay.
And I do have a Facebook page for the Detroit River Project. That is it, Detroit
okay.
River Project. I would love to have everybody go out and like it. I post a lot of things about the family and the work that's been going on here in Detroit.
Okay. And that's Detroit River Project. We type
Detroit
it in
River
just
Project.
That way at Facebook. Okay.
Yes.
Now, any of your relatives involved are mentioned in William Steele's book?
No, because my relatives did not travel that way.
Okay.
Mr. Steele's is a book of those on from the East Coast, and my family actually traveled in the Midwest, Kentucky, heading north, heading here. I would say that Mr. Steele's book is the seminal book study on the Underground Railroad, in particular the Underground Railroad from the East Coast. But there's a few others that are actually more Midwest-driven. Midnight to Dawn is one I can think of off the top of my head. And that's a lot about the abolitionist activity that happened in the middle of the country.
Okay. I also would like to remind our listeners, and also you, Kimberly, you could friend Leslie Gist on Facebook as well, if you haven't already. That's G-I-S-T. And her first name is L-E-S-L-E-Y. She is the executive producer of this program. And understand already that there are some great pictures at your site. And Carter G. Woodson, does that come into play in your story? Or
Carter
your reading?
Woodson?
Yeah, Carter G. Woodson.
Not in my story, but he should come into play in a lot of folks' story. Carter Woodson, besides being the father of what is known as African American History Month, he actually, that name should coincide with quite a few people. I would wager to guess they needed to do a little investigation on the Woodson family, because that is George Washington's family.
Okay. Do you have any upcoming events that you want our listeners to know about?
You know, unfortunately, I had a very large, very big event today. It actually took place this afternoon at 1:00. We celebrated the first reading of the Emancipation Proclamation in Michigan, which happened exactly 150 years ago today. And that was January 6, 1863, and it happened at historic Second Baptist Church, which is a very well-known Underground Railroad station here in the Midwest. And we actually had the Emancipation read today. It was reread. It was standing room only.
Mm-hmm.
Come coming up later on February the 20th, I am actually doing a presentation at the Detroit Historical Society on my family. I will be doing an hour-long presentation for their scholar series.
And where is that located?
The Detroit Historical Society is in Detroit.
Yeah, the address.
It is 5401 Woodward Avenue, Detroit.
And so, and you are a national and international presenter, and if any of our listeners wanted to contact you, they would do that through your email address or any
that
of those contacts that you gave us if they want you to come out and talk about the various projects that you're involved in?
Absolutely, or they can contact me through Facebook, of course.
Okay. What about those proclamations from the Senate and the Congress? Tell us a little bit about that.
The United States Senate and the United States House of Representatives unanimously presented the Detroit River Project and myself with concurrent resolutions that stated that the work we're doing, in particular, we are working on World Heritage Site designation for the historic Detroit River due to its Underground Railroad activity. There were approximately 50,000 people that crossed the Detroit River to freedom that would have traveled in the upper Midwest to cross the Detroit River to seek freedom. World Heritage Site status is something that both Parks Canada, which is the Canadian counterpart to the National Park Service here on the state side, have to concurrently agree because it is an international border, the Detroit River is.
We've already got that
agreement, and we're working on the two countries driven by the state of Michigan, which borders the Detroit River, and several counties on the Canadian side to get it to the United Nations UNESCO committee to have that happen. It'd be a fabulous addition to Detroit. Further, we are completing the book project that you mentioned a little earlier, and
okay.
We actually have suggested very strongly, and I'm working with five of the local universities here on what will be an international African-American and African-Canadian educational project to tell the story of the relationship between the two countries, in particular in this border region. That's what the book is about. That's who we are about. We are here in this area. Our lives are commingled, and the families, the lives, and the stories are all commingled. So United States Congress seems to think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Stay tuned.
We will. And Canada also celebrates Emancipation Week. Is that right?
Canada celebrates Emancipation the 1st of August. They were actually, Emancipation came to the country of Canada before us. It happened on August the 1st, 1835. So they were actually emancipated, roughly 30 years prior to us. And they still celebrate. That is actually Emancipation Day. August the 1st is a national holiday in Canada. And there has been since that day, every year, emancipation is celebrated by the African Americans and the African Canadians in this area. We celebrate that day as Emancipation Day because of the border, because of the fact that as the book is called, The Fluid Frontier, we have had the opportunity to, our stories have crossed for a very long time. So we celebrate emancipation every year on that day.
Okay. I want to remind our listeners to please tune in this Thursday night, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, as we go over Chapter 5 of the book, The Black Abolitionist by Benjamin Quarles. And again, that's Chapter 5. Please tune in for that. Now, you mentioned the book. We've talked about the book that you're involved with. I think there were 12 chapters and 6 from Canada, 6 from the United States. Are you working on any book projects around your family and their involvement in the Underground Railroad and all that rich history that you've been sharing with us tonight.
Yes, I actually am. We are writing, we wrote, when I say we, I have a co-writer. His name is Larry McClellan. He is a retired minister out of Chicago and a historian by night, a minister by day. We are actually, we completed the chapter. The chapter in the book is called Carolyn Quarles, A Remarkable Journey. We are going to expand on that chapter. We actually have been writing for about a year and a half and tell the whole family story. Carolyn's story has been told many times. There's two books, actually, out there that were written by a lady by the name of Julia Pfeifferdert, and that's two stories written on Carolyn. There is a mural project in downtown Milwaukee that tells her story, and it also tells the story of the Joshua Glover escape, which is two famous Milwaukee escapes, and they are literally under the city hall on an underpass. There are two plays that tour nationally. One is called A Midnight Cry, and has been done by the Dallas Children's Theater and actually made Broadway. So her story's out there, but it's never been told by the family. So,
there we go.
The answer to your question.
Yeah, we get it from. Yeah,
is
no,
to get it from the
horse's mouth. Get it from the horse's mouth, right on.
Absolutely.
We need to tell our own stories.
Absolutely.
Kimberly, my engineers tell me we're out of time. I really, really appreciate your being with us tonight. I consider it an honor to have been your host. And
well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Okay, and maybe we can get together in the future and talk some more.
I hope so.
Okay. All righty. Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.